again for you to be with us in this meeting tonight, to minister to our spirits, and nourish us in the Lord, and help us in our understanding. In Christ's name, amen. We've been really moving along in some things that are, well, let's see, pertaining to the natural mind and emotion and psyche. The fundamental tie to the scripture is actually in the point that these earthly processes function almost separately from the spirit. That is to say, they move in their own bailiwick, as it were, and the spirit moves in its bailiwick, in its area. The effort to try to tie the two together is a frustrating thing. And Paul makes that clear. He says, in my flesh there's no good thing. Now, if he believed that the spirit ought to clean up the flesh, he could hardly say that in the flesh there's no good thing. In these circles where they believe that they've got to bring the flesh into perfection via the spirit, it sounds good. But if Paul had intended that, if Paul thought that the flesh ought to be purified and made perfect or pious or whatever, he wouldn't have said so. He never would have said that in my flesh there dwells no good thing. And he would never have made the point of the conflict that says the spirit wants to do one thing and the flesh wants to do another. And Jesus made the same point. He said the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And that's the fundamental thesis that we're working on here. Now, the way you behave in the flesh has a lot of consequences, good, bad, and indifferent. You don't dare just simply consign the flesh to some hopeful spiritual experience. In other words, to think that you can go to an altar somewhere and pray through, as they say, and come away with your flesh purified, sanctified, and going down the right track and so forth. To do that is not only frustrating but risky, because you'll probably never really get your head together. There's a point where you have to behave yourself. And you can't just turn it over to Jesus, if you act ornery, you're going to lose friends. I'll tell you that right now. Now, whole thing bites in a little bit is when we talk about matters of marriage and friends, friendships, at the younger level. In marriage, you see, if a person, a wife or husband, doesn't behave themselves, they lose out. They lose the keen edge of affection. And all the solicitous behavior that's taken place before the marriage goes out the window after the marriage, and they wind up not liking each other, feeling guilty about that, because if they're Christians, they don't like each other. You are responsible for your behavior. You see, the other kind of approach is a cop-out. It looks very pious on the surface, very spiritual. Oh, I'm just going to have the love of Jesus anyway. It looks very pious to talk like that. But it can be the ultimate cop-out, where you just simply putting the responsibility over on Christ or Jesus to change your attitudes, and you never get down to the business of changing them. The affection thing, as I've said, is a very fragile thing. And it's not a matter of rights or obligations. It's a matter of what does it take to please the other person? What does it take to live graciously with people? Not just mates, not just marriage situations, but friendships, people in general. There are a lot of people out there that are totally inconsiderate of others. They're careless about their relationships. They're careless about keeping appointments. Careless about keeping in touch. There's many ways they're careless. The result is that friendships get frayed. you wind up losing friends. That's very pragmatic, you see. That may not have a whole lot to do with how spiritual you are. But there are a lot of marriages among Christians that are just sort of hanging on. A very surprisingly large number, because many times they simply haven't gotten down to the business of behaving themselves. They've put it all over on Christ and spirituality. They think if they read the Bible and pray that they're automatically going to be all right. But that's not true. So we've been working along on that angle, starting from the Old Testament point, which Solomon makes, or someone writing in the book of Proverbs makes, about a virtuous woman. Now, of course, we can think of in terms of both sides, virtuous men too, but the reason the matter of women came up is because this was the ending passage in the book of Proverbs, which we were studying. The fundamental issue is grace, or what is my opportunity in the name of Christ. This all goes back to taking a look at oneself and saying, what am I contributing to this marriage, for example, you see. Enjoy what you have, and don't spoil what you have by what you don't have. And I've put it another way and said, a lot of times a person has, let's say, a 75% good marriage, and they wreck it going for the other 25%. Never satisfied. If you're home three nights in the week, you want your home four. You know, if you're home four, you want it to be five. Always wanting what is not. And that's typical of human nature, not just wives, but husbands as well. Well, we always want what we don't have. Instead of taking advantage of what we do have and enjoying that, that's a matter of human behavior, not a matter of spirituality per se. Again, we go back to the fact that these are personality problems. They don't, not a matter of spirituality, but personality. And so it's profitable to talk about them. In a pragmatic way, how do people maintain a good relationship to each other? Again, I'm saying that a lot of very spiritual people in the world, when you count spirituality in terms of, you know, loving Christ and maybe serving Him and going to meetings and so forth, a lot of people are very spiritual in that sense, have bad relations at home because they put all their eggs in that basket and haven't given attention to the other. It's just like grooming yourself physically, taking care of yourself. You can be the most spiritual person in the world, and that's not going to comb your hair for you. You're still going to have to brush your teeth, no matter how spiritual you are. You're going to lose friends that way. You're going to lose friends, to say nothing of your molars, my cuspids. You know, it goes down to the same thing. It is necessary to take care of yourselves, necessary to behave yourselves. I don't talk much about those things in the meetings, in the sense of laying out regulations, because you all have to come to grips with yourselves in terms of your own personality needs. I'm not going to give you the satisfaction of thinking that just because you go to meetings, you're all right. All right, now, keeping the overall picture in mind, we're trying to assess the issue of human relationships, personal relationships, in that regard, to then determine something of the role of men and women in the world. That's what we're coming to ultimately. So, when you have a situation where both husband and wife, or we can always apply this in friendships, but I'll use the husband and wife factor here, but where you have two people, each of whom is solicitous of the other person's welfare and trying to do their best to please the other person, you're going to come out in pretty good shape. You've got one person who thinks everything ought to revolve around them. Wherever you go, whatever you do, whatever happens, number one has to be satisfied. That's really tough on a marriage. And in that kind of a case, such a person is always concerned about what they have a right to. When you forget about your own rights and think in terms of how you can help the other members of the family, not what do you have a right to, but what can you do for them, the spirit of the situation tends to equalize. When someone says, well, what would you like to do? The other person is maybe just as quick to say, well, what would you like to do? You know, it's an equalized situation. That preserves the friendship and the relationship. When the other person knows that your first concern is to please them, and you know that their first concern is to please you, you get together on it. You both enjoy the situation a lot more. That's not a matter of spirituality. That's a matter of personality. Now, in developing the idea of personality, there are many homes where people are brought up with the idea of giving. I've been in homes like that, many homes where everybody is sort of geared to the idea of what can we do for you? See, how can we help you? It's a wonderful thing to be in a home like that. And it seems to be a pattern that then is carried on, not by so much the genetic factor as by the habit that one has developed of being a giving person. You can teach your children to be giving persons. And not always with their hand out. Now, I think in Christendom we have developed and even produced the gimme syndrome, where the whole of one's Christian relationship is based on what can I get out of God? That's it. You go to meeting after meeting in certain groups. Everybody's out for what God's going to give me. Oh, Lord, give me the power, give me this, give me healing, give me a job, give me money, give me joy. And the whole issue is, what has God done for you lately? And that is monstrous. If a person stops to think about it, it seems so pious in religious circles. Well, what has God done for you lately? And the implication is, if you really, really have faith, God's going to do a lot of things for you. But as I pointed out in some articles, in fact, one's coming up where I made this point, it's like being in a family where the children are measured by how much they get out of mom and dad. You know, what have mom and dad done for you lately? And so it's the gimme syndrome that people come to Christ with. And that permeates the entire thing. Give me joy, give me tongue, give me money, you know, whatever. Always something for me. And in that kind of a syndrome, something of an indifference to whether anybody else gets anything or not. If somebody in the group is not getting healed, well, you sort of write them off because they don't have any faith anyway. If they're out of work, well, it's just they don't have enough faith. They're not trusting Christ. If they're worried about their family or worried about something, it's always a recrimination, you know, that you aren't praying enough or doing the right thing, or you're out of favor with God or something. See, so the whole of the life with Christ is measured by what you're able to get out of Him. And that develops the very self-oriented pattern. So some people have as much trouble living with Christ as they do living with their husbands or wives. You know, they wouldn't be satisfied with Him. They had Christ for a husband. A year from then, they'd be trying to get a divorce because He didn't fix the doorknob. And He's a carpenter. Well, you know, we're getting down to the nitty-gritty here of saying that successful marriages, successful friendships, successful attitudes toward the roles of husbands and wives or men and women has to start with an openness about the meaning of living with persons. And you can make all kinds of excuses why people don't like you. Do a little rethinking of what they're all about. All right, now, in the personality pattern, getting into the issue of conflicts, which is, you know, we're coming down to the nitty-gritty here. Conflicts between persons usually center around, in one way or another, ego defense. That is the preservation of one's self-image. And this is at the heart of this whole issue of roles of men and women. A matter of insecurity, part of one or another, trying to preserve their own self-image, a place for them in the sun for themselves. And that's what is the essence of many arguments in the home and among friends. The arguments usually center around the fact that a person doesn't like to be shown to be wrong. They don't want to give in, not because the other idea isn't maybe better. Because you see, to be proven wrong, or to admit one is wrong, a sort of an admission of failure. Now, it happens all the time among teenagers and parents. And you have to understand that going in, you see, you're not going to make it. I taught high school for a number of years, and I know what it means to tussle with teenagers. You're involved with a whole room full of teenagers. Parents can't handle them, and they've just come fresh from scrapping with their parents. And they hate adults, and they hate teachers especially. They don't want to be there in the first place, or second or third place either. And so here you face this room full of youth. You imagine the task of trying to get an hour's worth of instruction in to that kind of a situation where you've got 35 or 40 different young people, each of which has come from a different background, each of which has his own inner conflicts, and most of whom are negative about the situation when they step in the door. One of the things you have to understand is this matter of ego. Not wrong, see. We have ego defenses. We've been talking about them Saturday morning. You have ego defenses, which are important to maintain your self-respect. Now, this is in the flesh. In the spirit, we understand already that there is no self-respect. Now, from Christ's point of view, the flesh is not capable of handling the spiritual matter. So you have to start with the idea that apart from Christ, you're nothing. But now we've got to live in the flesh. We've got to function on this earth. And there's a certain amount of self-confidence and self-respect that is important to functioning on the earth. And when people lose respect for themselves, they also lose the motivation for proper behavior. Now, that's very important in marital situations. When a husband or wife loses respect for themselves because of the criticisms of the other person, now that carries over into a person's relationship to Christ, because there are lots of Christians. I'd say probably 75% of all Christians, and that's a low figure, believe that the Lord isn't really satisfied with them. Because they've been given the feeling every time they walk in the door of the church that they haven't done enough. You haven't witnessed enough or read your Bible enough or prayed enough, no matter how much you do. It's never enough. You always got to head down the sawdust trail, make another dive. You know? I mean, that's what they say in the rescue missions. You know? They take a dive so they can get some food. It means they go down to the altar. In a lot of rescue missions, I spent a lot of time working them, and a lot of places they don't give them something to eat until they accepted Christ. The mood seems to be from the pulpit that in order for this to be a successful meeting, we've got to get a lot of people to take a dive.
for whatever reason. You can come forward because you're not working hard enough, or because you didn't give enough money, or because you, you know, whatever, you slip back and don't enjoy yourself as much, enjoy the Lord, whatever it is. But that kind of leverage, it gives a built-in sense that the Lord is never satisfied. And that's what happens in young people, where the parents are too quick to criticize and don't compliment or praise enough. Now, we bring that over into relationships with husbands and wives, or relationships with friends, especially with husbands and wives, where they have a little better aim at each other, a little closer range. You get the feeling that your mate is never satisfied, no matter what you do. And no matter what the woman cooks for dinner, the guy never compliments her or praises her for it. He just comes in and scarfs the stuff up and belches and goes on. I've been at dinner table in homes, and I hear what the husband is saying to the wife, and I think, you sap, why don't you, I don't know why he's telling that, but you know, she's gone to work preparing a nice dinner, and there's some little thing that doesn't suit him, and I want to punch him, see. He's got a good wife, and she's trying to fix the food for him, and he ought to just eat it and keep his mouth shut. You can talk all night about spirituality, that you can destroy a marriage over stupidity and inconsiderateness, carelessness with each other. And all the spirituality in the world won't save a marriage like that. Now, going back to the ego defense thing, in arguments, the root of arguments usually is not that the other person, that each one is really trying to get the truth, but each one is trying to save respect for themselves as a person. And arguing, the worst thing you can ever do are debating. You should never argue. You shouldn't argue. You should discuss a thing. But the worst thing you can do is to say to the other person, well, you're just wrong, that's all, you know. And to imply thereby that you're stupid. And I've been in lots of situations like that where the way the wife responds, or the husband, either way, is such that it's a put-down. It isn't enough to say, well, maybe you ought to look at it this way. The guy has got to dominate. He's got to say, well, I just want you to know you're nuts. But you don't, you know, you've got to leave it open. Because none of us knows enough to, in the first place, to tell the other person that, you know, that they're ignorant or stupid or whatever. Even if it were reasonable manners, it's still dumb in the first place because we don't know that much. But I've seen people argue over the dumbest things. You know, what color was that car that ran the red light, almost hit us? Husband says, boy, we almost got hit. It was that green Ford that came running through the stop sign, nearly hit us. And the wife said, what do you mean green? It was red, you know. You're crazy, it was green. You know, so back and forth. Or the color of the wallpaper, or whatever. People can find the silliest things to debate about, argue about. It's all the game of ego defense. So why don't you just recognize it to begin with and do the smart thing, or you'd say, well, you may be right, dear. Well, maybe it's a red car. But you see, people always pull this old snaggletooth saw out. It's a matter of principle. Why? Well, I'm always right. And that would be true in discussions you have about Christ, especially true. You never win an argument. Because if you win the argument, you lose the person. Why? Because people don't want you to win the argument over them. Instead of insisting on the absoluteness of your rectitude, you know, you can always say, well, I know you've thought about it, and that you think that's a reasonable position, and but maybe you ought to think about this thing. Instead of trying to prove they're wrong, offer your own view. And that's true of all discussions and debates with people. If you care about people, you don't worry about winning the argument. If they want to go through life believing something that may be an error, That's up to them. You have no responsibility to straighten out everybody's head in the world. If they want help, they say, well, I'm not sure about this. This is what I've always thought, but maybe you can give me some enlightenment on it. Fine. Now you've got a deal. But don't ever put argument above person. Ever. And when you see an argument building between yourself and another person, stop and ask yourself, is it worth it to sacrifice the relationship over this argument? What do you are thought to be wrong or not? I mean, the other person may go away thinking you're wrong. What difference does that make? Is that so vital? Ask yourself how much the friendship is worth, that you're willing to destroy it in an effort to prove yourself right. Let it go and preserve the friendship. Because, remember, as long as you give the other person the self-respect they're looking for, they will not press the argument. That's the whole point, see? That's what they're after. They're not after the truth. They're after self-respect. And you give them credit. And persons who come to you with arguments about the faith, you have to say, well, you may have a point there, you know, and I know you thought a lot about this, and you're an intelligent person. Did you ever consider this angle? See? And if you get into things like evolution, people want to believe that there's an evolutionary process. The thing you want them to do is to get to Christ. Now, if you think, well, you can't be consistent as a Christian and believe in evolution, I'd like to pose for you the following problem. 99% of all human beings I've ever talked to are not all that consistent. For example, all the flap about humanitarianism. We got to save the world. We owe the world a living. We've got to feed the world. We've got to be humanitarian. All this stuff. In the last election, the side that lost has been pressing the point continually. Everybody that voted for the other side is selfish and greedy. That's why you voted the other way, because you're selfish and greedy. Now, the same group that point out the selfishness of America were enraged over the idea of bringing religion into the question, into politics. See? Is that consistent? If you're going to eliminate God from the picture, why should you not be selfish? Why not be greedy? If we're animals, be a lion. He'll take the largest chunk of leg he can get. He'll be a squirrel. Now, if you want to say we all are children of God and have a responsibility to the world, that's consistent. Point I'm making, it, I've talked to groups of politicians, political scientists, educators, intellectuals, philosophers, and I can't get any clear-cut response that says, that's right, we're inconsistent if we try to press humanitarianism and we don't include God. They won't accept it. One of the last presentations I made in a group of political scientists. And I'm saying that only the love of Christ within can really effectively, and these are to Christian people, incidentally, can effectively reach out to the needs of the world. And this person was saying, well, isn't the love the Buddhist has just as good, and the love of the Hindu, and all that kind of stuff? You can't get the point across. Only the Spirit of Christ within produces the love. You can't just have a religious kind of love for people. It's got to be deeper than that. But what I'm saying is, don't try to press consistency. You can't even get consistency among the intellectuals. The scholars are not consistent. I don't know that I've ever heard a lecture yet from a scholar that didn't have elements of inconsistency in it. We're not consistent, generally. As a general rule, don't try to get consistency from people. Don't say, well, you're inconsistent. You believe this and this. They'll never see it anyway. They'll never admit it. So instead of saying that, say, well, I know you believe what you believe very strongly, and maybe it helps you. You don't have to say, oh, yes, you're right. You don't have to do that. I'm not talking about compromise where you're being dishonest. I'm talking about letting the other person have their what? Self-respect. You have to figure out how to do that. But that's what the argument is all about. The subject matter is secondary. The first rule of harmonious human relationships is to give the other person their self-respect. And you'll avoid an awful lot of needless arguments. Because you cut the footing right out from under the whole argument.